Welcome to the 2009 Washington, D.C. Sunstone Symposium. This session is Why I Stay with Jalen Prince. My name is Tom Kimball. I'd like to take a minute and introduce Jalen. Jalen is from Potomac, Maryland. She's attended BYU. She's the president of the Madison House Foundation, an organization serving autistic teens and adults. She's a graduate, studying graduate studies at American University, Arts Administration, Wesley Theological Seminary, in theology. She's the founder and president of Times and Seasons, an arts management consulting firm emphasizing arts, broadcasting, public policies, and public relations. She's been an instructor in the Evergreen Program at Johns Hopkins. She's been involved in public relations with the Bicentennial Council of the 13 Original States. She's been a management consultant for Hammond Associates, press secretary to U.S. Congressman, a radio announcer, theater critic, producer of, and director of television and theater, and the owner of Pioneer Playhouse, a summer stock theater in the Rocky Mountains. We're looking forward to what you have to say.
With that, I was assured that it would be a very small group.
And it is.
Why do I stay? Let me answer that question in three parts. First, some reminiscences to build context. Second, some experiences that have helped shape my thinking. And third, my conclusions. The well-examined life is a life fully lived, someone once said, or at least they should have. We are on a journey, and that is the joy of traveling through this thing called life. Yet some are in a rush to get to their destination, and others enjoy the process of getting to a new address. I select to live in the now, and I hope that the destination that I eventually reach is the place that I want to be. But just in case it isn't, I hope that this journey is an eventful one. So if I end up at a location that I had not imagined, the time spent on this planet will have been worth all of the cosmic fuss it took to provide this orb that we so complacently call home. Let me tell you a bit about my journey. Like many of you, I grew up in a small Utah town. Or should I say that I grew up in two small Utah towns, and they each helped me place my feet on an interesting path. Around the turn of the last century, my family was busily involved in a growing industry in Utah that later would bring world attention to the area. My Scandinavian grandparents helped to usher skiing into Utah in Summit County. They were drawn to Utah because of Mormonism, but could not leave their skis behind. So many of my family members settled around Park City, Utah, a mining town surrounded by amazing ski slopes. When you grow up in a mining town in Utah, one becomes acutely aware of attitudes and how Brigham Young viewed mining communities. He was suspicious about anyone who earned their living by getting things from under the ground. He preferred people to earn their livelihood working on the surface of the land. Park City had been known for its silver mines, and for many fortunes and reputations were made there. Some miners that had been employed with the railroad found their way to Park City. Some stopped as they were moving westward, and others just needed work. Brigham saw miners as drifters and outsiders. He did not care for the diversity that came with a mining town. Brigham much preferred the life that rendered a living by tilling the earth's surface. The agrarian life was much more desirable to his thinking, and he had more control over those who were farmers, especially when you consider what would happen on payday on Friday and Saturday nights. Farmers didn't have those issues. Miners had a way of coming in from many locations, and they may have been churched. Most likely, they had not been brought into Mormonism. So in Brigham's eyes, they were an unruly bunch. The same mountains that brought silver miners to Park City also hosted some of the best snow west of Scandinavia. So by sheer happenstance, an interesting alliance between my Mormon family and the Gentiles of Park City was forged. I was the last cousin to be born in the Rasmussen line. I was doted on by my family and community. My grandmother had become a skillful businesswoman in the area. She and her children were important members of the community. So being my father's only child brought much focus on me. Shortly after I was born, it was said that most of the community came to call it our home. Many of these people were close family friends and were the remnants of the mining community that had flourished decades before my birth in Park City. I had dolls given me from members of the Greek Orthodox community. Lutherans and Presbyterians brought us bottles of jams and jellies. And an agnostic man that ran the cafe at Kimball's Junction, just a mile from my home, was reported to be a boxer who had a minor career and had given up boxing because one of his opponents had died in the ring. But this man was always protective of me. But my fondest friend was the Irish Catholic priest, who was a terrible driver, and accidentally ran over my pet black rabbit one day as it hopped into the road as he was making a visit to our home. I don't know if the death of the rabbit may have been the reason that Father Cullen would always look for me on the Park City hillsides during the city's 4th of July celebration and give me a quarter. Now, remember, in the 50s, that quarter would buy 25 pieces of penny candy. Enough candy to keep a kid on a sugar fix for at least 3 days. The coin may have been some sort of penitence for having done it my rabbit. But nonetheless, I loved this bundle of diverse people. And when my grandmother died and the family began a feud because she left no will, it was difficult for me to move to a new town, even if it was only 18 miles away. Heber would have been a dream community in Brigham Young's view, with many farmers and dairymen. There were even a few cattlemen and sheep ranchers. The cattlemen were never too thrilled with the families who owned sheep because the sheep grazed too heavily on the mountain grassland. But they all qualified for Brigham's praise, in his view, because they had two things in common. They grew things that lived on the land, and they were of one faith, and that was Mormon. At age 7, I was confused when I would hear references made by my new Heber classmates about the people from Park City and how bad the people were. Bad? I knew them to be generous, kind, and friendly. Maybe they weren't the best drivers, but they looked out for one another, and they loved their families. How could they be bad? And this was the first time I encountered the word Gentile. I would often return to Park City on Memorial Day and other family days, and then I would hear comments on the other side made to my parents. How do you like being in a town with so many narrow-minded Mormons? My mother would shrug her shoulders and go on with catching up on the news. I heard it whispered that the Heber group could be a bit self-righteous. I wasn't sure what self-righteous meant, but I knew it wasn't a term of endearment. Eventually, I would grow to defend my Heber friends when the Park City crowd would make such comments, and vice versa. It was always a challenge for me in high school when our two schools would play one another in sports. On the Heber side, the rivalry was much deeper than sports. It was almost an endorsement of who God thought was most worthy. The Park City crowd was more philosophical and viewed a game just as a game. But in one arena, both Park City and Heber acknowledged a really tough high school. That was a heretic Catholic school in Salt Lake called Judge Memorial. It was recognized by all of the sports division that the Judge guys were in a different league. They played dirty. It was rumored that the Catholic faculty would insist on self-defense tactics, or would instill self-defense tactics in their players, that would often come out in inappropriate ways on the playing field. In later years, I learned why the Judge Memorial students were taught to fight. It was a necessary skill needed when children of the Salt Lake Saints would corner them and admonish them with their fists that their school was of the devil. My mother also had made accommodations for her friends on both sides of the religious aisle, to borrow a Washington metaphor. My mother was a kindly lady at that time, and always encouraged me to look out for the underdog. She could not bear to see an unkind thing done to an innocent being. She encouraged me to play with all of the kids in my class, even the Gentiles, and it wasn't the cool thing to do. Though I had relatives that came across the plains in the handcars, my mother had been baptized Episcopalian in Salt Lake because her family had been divided as a result of some cruelty that had happened because of polygamy. And my grandmother and grandfather had parted ways with their church and the church that they had viewed as inflicting pain on women because of polygamy. Mother had joined the Mormon church as a young adult and reared all of her children in Mormonism. Her insistence on inclusion of others must have come from being a child on the outside in her schooling in Salt Lake. My maternal grandparents met at the Chicago World's Fair. Grandpa, a Gentile, was from the Midwest, but willingly moved to Salt Lake to marry my grandmother. Grandpa had a gift of conversation, and my family recalls his conversation on world events and politics and how people were being treated in the world. My paternal grandparents told a story that my grandmother came to Salt Lake because she fell for a missionary that had labored in Norway. She came to the U.S. as his fiancée. While at a Sunday dinner with these parents, who were very prominent, her young man became extremely critical of his mother and rather curt about her leaving a salt cellar on the table during dessert. Grandma, seeing how he treated his mother, knew what would be in store for her if they married. As she left that afternoon, she handed the young man her engagement ring. She later married a Danish returned missionary and had four children. Later, she would become the breadwinner because her young husband developed asthma and would eventually take his life prematurely. I began developing my attitudes and viewpoints with this backdrop, but I would like to add a bit more to my background so it can be understood more clearly my placement in Mormonism today. Living in the small town of Heber, I learned to do most everything. Perhaps it was because most people there were able to do most things, at least physically. Many people held two jobs, teacher, farmer, carpenter, salesperson, lumberman, mayor, grocery clerk, and piano teacher, county sheriff, and owner of a resort, and so on. In the process of supporting the family, each person could and did have many different jobs in town. I saw my neighbor, who was a hairdresser and artist, build floats for the county fair parades out of chicken wire and pastel napkins. She would design grand structures that were sparkly and flowing and beautiful in her backyard garage, and I was her apprentice for several years. In adulthood, I studied design. As a teen, I learned to direct roadshows and productions, and I ended up owning a summer stock theater for 3 years in college. I learned oratory and became a radio announcer for ABC and a congressional speechwriter. Learned piano, sang in choirs, and painted pictures and oils, and became an arts administrator. I helped to put on ward dinners, funerals, and weddings. I currently sponsor dozens of events each year and had an autism foundation. Each of these skills I learned in part long before I entered college. I learned them in a small mountain town. Miscellaneous skills I also learned by my Mormon community: knitting, sewing, costume design, flower arranging, cross stitch, how to make four varieties of funeral potatoes, how to pitch a tent, organize a dance festival, how to cook hot cakes and eggs for 500 at 6 o'clock in the morning for the 4th of July, how to put on a dance, make posters. I mastered the skill of using cream of mushroom soup and layers of Jell-O. I know how to freeze vegetables, bottle fruit, and I know that it takes at least 11 cartons of napkins and 7 rolls of chicken wire to make an average county fair float. And that it is best to learn the color of the girls' prom dresses that will be riding the float before ordering the color of napkins for them. I have also a haunting voice in my head that says if I buy a new dress, that I must wear it to church before I can wear it elsewhere. I also learned to be an adult. At the age of 11, after my father's early death from cancer, I became half of a household, having to weigh in on decisions on which hot water heater to buy, which roof tile to put on the house. I became head of a household overnight. I painfully viewed the treatment, too, of my mother as she learned the skills necessary to support herself and a daughter. And I saw the difficulties she had to overcome in trying to be equally compensated as her male counterparts for the same job. And then I also learned religious lessons. I learned that you could pray anywhere, anytime. I delighted in the concept of free agency and human potential. And that man and woman can do most anything, because I had seen it happen. I had grown up with doers, capable, strong people with acute survival skills and great inner strength. And here where I encountered the mystical and grew to understand how God could communicate with someone young, inquisitive, and trusting. If God could make me an adult of sorts overnight, why could he not inspire a young man earnestly seeking guidance in the growth? I understood how a youth in New York State who was following the light he was given could spark the spiritual imagination of many around him. With this understanding, I listened intently in church and seminary about all things spiritual, and I too trusted. Hebrew was a good place to grow up, and I was conscious of that fact and how ideally it was located between Provo and Salt Lake. And I had protective mountains around me. But even then, I knew there were things beyond my mountaintop horizons that I needed to experience, and different things I needed to see beyond my mountain valley. Perhaps my knowledge of the Park City community helped me question some of the rhetoric that I had heard in Heber and feel the need to know more about a larger world. I loved the individuals that had taught me many things that would serve me for the remainder of my life. But I became skeptical when these people acted as a unit. Often the individuals were reasoned and kind, but when acting together, they seemed as if their position in the community depended on being perceived as being rigid. The more unyielding they seemed, the higher their position in the community. Yet when engaged on one-on-one conversation, they seemed quite sensible, even inspirational. When I viewed them collectively, I grew suspicious and cautious. There was a strong requirement of conformity. Now my tongue's getting tied. I tried for many years to be super Mormon. We would have 3 sessions of state conference at 10, 2, and 7. Most went to 2 sessions, but for years I attended all 3. I wanted to prove myself as a worthy member of the community. I knew I had to define myself because I was without a father. Most children in town had a place in the community that was reflected by their father's position in the church. Since I had no father in town and the remainder of my family still lived in Park City, I had a lot of work to do to prove myself as being a worthy member of the community. I never missed church, MIA, or seminary. I volunteered for everything. I attended meetings, lots of meetings, and including the annual morality lesson, where a slice of buttered bread is handed to one person in the crowd, and they were asked to lick the butter off the slice. Then the bread is passed to another person and told to eat that slice that had once been buttered with the bread, at which point everyone became quite repulsed. But the point would be made, young ladies, When you lose your virtue, then you are like bread with the butter licked off. I've seen some silly things, and I've also seen some sad things. I saw things that have been played out before in other conservative communities over the centuries. Nothing new, yet disturbing. Disturbing things to a young person's sensibilities. I knew a member of our bishopric who beat his own daughter when she began to have a high school crush on a young man that was a non-member and had moved to town to live with his grandparents. Her father was the same man I had joined in morning prayer, kneeling at our chair sides when I would have sleepover with his daughters. I heard the condemnation of one of the three physicians in town because he performed abortions. Yet many of the people complaining had sought out the doctor's help when their teenage daughters had become pregnant. This is a place where a woman confessed an early sin of immorality and was excommunicated, and when she would not identify her counterpart. But her phrase in later years was, "You confess and you're excommunicated. You keep your mouth shut and you're made a bishop." Years later, this bishop's barn was burned to the ground by another jilted lover. Maybe there is divine justice. But this is the same community that flocked to the hospital to give blood when somebody in their congregation lost lots of blood in an accident. This happened dozens of times. And in recent time, I know of a member of a bishopric who willingly gave one of his kidneys to a young girl when he discovered he was a tissue match. I have seen church and community at its best and worst, and find that it is much more complex than many of us want it to be. I have always seen community as being an intricate waltz, and that not every step is smooth, but the goal is a flowing movement that allows each enough area on the floor to move with adequate space, joined by others following the same music, and sometimes that music is syncopated. Several years ago, I was drawn to study theology. I had inquired many years earlier about becoming part of the LDS seminary teacher's curriculum and was rejected by the BYU religion department, saying, "We don't hire women and don't have any interest in educating people we won't employ." For 20 years, I had longed for serious religious study and often found myself drawn to a sign on Massachusetts Avenue here in Washington, reading Wesley Theological Seminary. I imagined the conversations that students would have inside those walls, and I mentioned it in my interest to my husband. And one day, a patient of his mentioned she was a student there. Greg had her make arrangements and send me the information about the school, and before I knew it, not only was I enrolled, but I was engaged in the conversations I had longed for. Respectful, challenging conversations about God, creation, the purpose of life, personal responsibility, community, and talking about the responsibility of the religious to those of different beliefs and to those in poverty. My encounter with Wesley was begun cautiously. At the beginning of each new class, we were asked to introduce ourselves and tell what church we attended and why we were enrolled in the class. I would give my name and would quickly say my congregation was in suburban Maryland, and then tell them that I was looking for a place to engage in serious religious study. Sometimes near the end of the semester, it would come out that I was a Mormon. I had comments ranging from, "I didn't know Mormons could be reasonable," to, "Will your leaders excommunicate you for attending a seminary?" to, "I didn't know Mormons had a belief in Christ." I discovered most of my classmates who were going to become ordained ministers in any one of a number of denominations had never even talked seriously about religion with a Mormon who was not interested in converting them. And I had no intention of going to their church and trying to convert anyone. By being willing to learn, I was included in many wonderful things. I traveled to Rome with a friend of mine, as you believe me too, to be part of a conference with the Methodists and Benedictines of the Vatican. We even toured the most revered collections of the Vatican. I was warmly welcomed, and I have even maintained Christmas correspondence with two Vatican associates. I conversed with monks, pastors, nuns, cardinals, and papal advisors, and had long conversations with several of the Vatican's highest officiants. Many inquired why a Mormon woman would take the time to be at such an event, because in their view, I came from a church that didn't value anything the Catholics had to say about religion. I found myself in a position of defending my Mormon faith to those in Rome. And then when I came home, I had to defend to members of my ward here in Maryland that I need not be viewed suspiciously because I had had conversations with Catholic leaders. I traveled halfway around the world only to have images of Heber and Park City revisited. One summer, I traveled on a biblical archaeological expedition to a site in Jordan with archaeologists from Wesley. We participated in dig with Adventists and other biblical researchers. I spent time examining fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I heard many different stories told by the scholars there working on the scrolls that I had not heard from farms at BYU. A much more complex and nuanced story. You may ask how this plays into the well-examined life. Clearly, one must have a context for one's actions and what we do in life. None of us works from a void to make the arrangements of our lives. We gather the buds from the foliage that is in our gardens, and each of us arranges those elements into the bouquet of life in many different ways. We all may walk through the same garden and notice very different things. This perspective may give you a bit of an idea of the garden I walked through to formulate the arrangement I have made of my life. I feel life is composed of the intentional and the serendipitous. Some feel that all is planned and organized, but I think that the serendipitous happens, and I think that God sometimes works with the serendipity. If we believe in the divine creation, I think God must have had amazing moments where God smiled and was happy to see the way colors fused together spontaneously in some situations, and the panoramas that weren't in the plans evolved because many elements came together as surprises in an otherwise ordered process. All of this exposure to other thoughts and religions and cultures, and you ask, why does she remain Mormon? I've grown to have adult beliefs, and I admit there are things that I don't know, never will in this life. I love what I have seen of this world. Even in the most difficult situations, I see beauty. Mormonism has given me that optimism. I see even in the despair and pain of the Psalms that there is hope. I see glimmer and beauty in leprosy colonies. I recall beautiful people battling HIV and AIDS, and I see that Mormonism has helped me formulate those views, and that it is part of the landscape of the American experience that we have endless capabilities, and I haven't found that basic hope in conversations in many other backgrounds. Many have tried to paint Mormonism as a take-it-all-or-leave-it situation. If I saw it in those terms, I would be sad, and I may not be able to stay. Some leaders see that there is unity in all people doing the same thing in the same measure at the same time. I don't see that. Because we all enter the picture at different times with different needs and tolerances, and thus we develop at different rates and with different experiences. Let's look at Mormonism as the smorgasbord or a buffet. We are offered a huge array of items. For me, it is impossible to put a bit of everything on my plate at one time. Now, over a process of time, if I return to the table, I may sample most of the fare. In time, I may have developed new tastes and need new things to nourish my soul. And I may have become wary of other items before me, and I may try things that I had not paid attention to at first, or they may have been hidden from me and from my view. And then there are items that are unhealthy for me at different parts of my life. Maybe they just make my blood pressure go up. But I need to take from that table what I can handle and digest and try new things as they nourish my being. I've learned to manage my clatter and not feel guilty that some things must be passed over or ignored at times in order to secure spiritual survival. If I truly see life as a journey, I must revisit my spiritual table at different times and partake of the necessary items relevant for each time frame in my life. Karen Armstrong tells the story of an Eastern religious experience. A young man is carrying a canoe and comes to a large lake that he must cross on his journey. He comes to a large lake that he's encountering on his journey, and he gets into a canoe and safely rows to the far side of the lake. Getting out of the vessel, he sees ahead of him a tall, rugged mountain with very steep paths. Now the young person is perplexed by a new dilemma because the canoe had brought him thus far on the journey. Was he obligated to carry the canoe with him up the mountain? Or is it acceptable to leave it behind and grasp new tools from the next part of the trek and not be burdened with the obligation of carrying something with him that had served him well once but was no longer needed? Armstrong equates this story to one's obligation to Scripture and whether we are obligated to carry some things that's not of service to us in the journey at the moment. I struggle with this concept, yet I see at times I need to go on my journey with new and different tools and different nourishment. I am asked if I believe the Joseph Smith story, and my adult response is that much greater understanding than I've had in my youth. I see that he is part of a foundational story that is vital for a successful community. In archaeology, you find remnants of these stories of creation, and they help all communities to formulate. As Americans, we tell of pilgrims, founders of the Constitution, Washington chopping down the cherry tree, and stories of heroism by Paul Revere. These common stories bring us together with a common bond as a nation. Romans have Romulus and Romulus. Aboriginals in Australia have 40,000 years of stories told of barren lands without man and woman, but how they came about and how the rivers were formed. These stories have been foundational for these people for millennia. In Christianity, we have our creation narrative that brings us to the same page, and we can all be claimed under a common profession of a singular story about the birth of an infant in a manger. Thus it is with Mormonism. Joseph Smith is the foundational person with whom we were called to relate. We are told he had an encounter with the divine and that he and others have been changed because of his experience. No, that may not be a warm, fuzzy testimony, but it is an insight gained by reason and faith, tempered with a lot of hope. In my foundational story, it is my foundational story, and I respect it. And I remember when I was in a small town and felt God's presence. And why is this not a good foundational story? It is. From the onset, I grew up defending others that were not like me and then justifying those of my faith to the broader religious community. Experiences of this nature have remained part of my life, and I've found myself defending other faiths when thoughtful comments were made by my co-religionists about the practice of other groups. I've also defended my faith as others have demonstrated their ignorance or intolerance or lack of understanding toward the good people I have grown to love in my faith. If I can believe the Joseph Smith story to be crucial to my interreaction with my co-religionists, then I too must make room for others to hold on to their foundational stories. I find that the diet of words that I once had no longer served me adequately. I can't indulge the linguistic, every fiber of my being, are phrases like, beyond a shadow of a doubt. I must use grown-up words that reflect the experiences and the religious study that I have had. To be true to myself, I must select words I use to describe my spiritual journey, or why take the journey. I have learned that we are weak in our use of language to express our religious lives. My time at Wesley has given me the words to more accurately describe my relationship to God. I have learned a more common religious vernacular. And somebody mentioned, maybe I'm religiously bilingual. I find my relationship with the divine fluctuates, and my need to describe where I am at different times requires different words. I have found more similarities to other faiths than I found differences. In fact, I created a class that I taught at Johns Hopkins that focused on the similarities in world religions rather than our differences. We are all trying to answer the same questions of beginning and end, and we want to make the process of exiting this life something meaningful. We do have a unique view of life after this, and eternal life rings true to me. I've read enough of other religious groups to be very satisfied with this concept. Some others portray God, who has created man, and the reason that he has created man was for no more purpose than to just make God happy and for God's pleasure. I feel this is fundamentally an assault on the nature of God. However, I feel too that we often bring God down to a too human vantage point and act like God is sitting at our kitchen table. I do feel God is much grander than this concept allows. We have a 20-year-old daughter, Lauren, and I'm amazed at her knowledge of technology. At Christmas, she placed me on Facebook and also led the way for my new iPhone. And as I considered this address, I started to see a similarity of my beliefs and my telephone. Let me elaborate. To have a working phone, you must have a server. Over the past 2 years, we have had 3 different domestic servers and several foreign ones. These servers make it possible to communicate to areas that I could not communicate with on my own. Last summer, while doing some photography in Guatemala, Lauren and I had to secure a phone that worked with a server in that location because the phone system we had here in the U.S. was inadequate. Our new Guatemalan phone worked well there, but it did not service here at home. Of our 3 domestic servers, each had its strengths and weaknesses. Some dropped calls when it was detrimental. Another didn't allow me to make return calls from my voicemail. And one, we could not receive any calls at our new home. We settled on a new server, and it allows a broad range of communication, better than any I've had before. But without adaptation, even this good server will not work in Africa or Central America, India, Russia, and so on. I have to get a local chip in those locations or have other servers connect me to the ones with whom I want to talk. I see the Mormon Church as a server to enable me to have a more effective communication with the divine. My server may not be effective for all people in different locations in this world or with different needs. They may require different servers at different times to help them in their communications. I cannot judge what server best helps others. I know that I have a religious server that is good for me, not flawless, but it serves me well and aids me in my communication with God so I can express my needs and also learn what is expected of me. Maybe I can help make my server a better size so others can utilize it for their communication with God. I want to see what I see that is good and praiseworthy about my server is that it develops men who are, for most part, very helpful with their children and also dedicated mothers. I see people like Esther Peterson, whose independence was fostered by the pioneer women in her family, using the same server I had. Esther's strength and insight made her an instrument that has affected nearly every living person on this planet, Every country has adopted her labeling model for telling the nutritional value of food products. This was done to help poor working women in America figure out what foods were good for their children and help give them information for a balanced diet. Her system has been adopted around the world. You can see her influence on every food package you pick up as you read the list of calories and nutrients. She also organized women in sweatshops to defend their families from hunger. She served in 3 White Houses, and her influence is felt in every American kitchen. Esther learned these fundamental organizational skills at a young age in a mountain community not far from mine. I photograph NGOs around the world and have seen many. It started by Mormons, caring people that act out their caring using skills that they have learned in their communities. I do flinch when I see humanitarian efforts so motivated to make conversions that they try to turn tribal individuals into Salt Lake clones. But when they are trying to do what is good because it is right, they are magnificent. I love a community not dictated by alcohol, which helps me keep my relationships less complicated. Though there have been plenty of times that I would have loved to have spiked the punch at a Mormon gathering. So people would be more relaxed and stay at a dinner or reception beyond 9 p.m. I do feel more comfortable conversing with people who have not had one glass of wine too many. And I relish being part of one of the first smoke-free communities. Perhaps that comes from losing a father to lung cancer and knowing that the reduction of smoking can help prolong my friend's life. I value being able to call on someone in my ward if I'm in need, and I deem it a privilege to be allowed into the inner circle of the family in my ward as they are dealing with illness or death, and be able to be of assistance and supportive. The things that I have learned at these moments, too, connect me to my many friends from other religious traditions, because those moments are universal, and they can help me connect with others on a very real and unfiltered level. I'm not under any delusion that all in the Mormon Church is as it should be, and that my server is perfect. I hope it can grow as I hope to grow. I don't like the current overemphasis on blind obedience. Personally, I want more lessons on how to be a better person and how to feel renewed when I leave church, with a resolve to be a better person this week than I was last week. I've been taught that I have been given special gifts, though, spiritual ones. And one is a personal revelation to help me discern my path, though I may need the wisdom of others around me and some leaders to give me a perspective on their viewpoints. I know that God will guide my path and open doors so I can accomplish my unique role in life's journey. To me, personal revelation trumps blind obedience. As a youth, I loved hearing about free agency. David O. McKay seemed to get that at the heart of that idea. I had the freedom to express my love for God by volunteering and doing the right things, not simply because I was told to do so. Free will demonstrated is one of the most powerful things and actions of saying thank you to anything on earth. But I've seen through recent years many church leaders frightened by that concept. I don't see free agency as permission to do ill, but as an admonition to learn the lessons taught in the New Testament on how Jesus lived his life. Free agency is an endorsement to figure out the best and kindest way of traversing through this life. I see the Book of Mormon, too, falling into a core set of stories about which communities form that can motivate my community and be a common bound. I am saddened when we emphasize the Book of Mormon over Hebrew Scripture or New Testament. I've grown to love these books in my theological studies, and I see mankind struggling to understand the nature of God. Excuse me. and realize her own shortcomings in relationship to God. I have been taught to see me and you in these biblical studies and struggles. And I see we can grow as a community if we learn from these stories and not view them just as proofs for the existence of Mormonism. These scriptures are so much more than an endorsement story that foreshadows the coming of Mormonism. Learning to know our biblical counterparts is comforting because I know that my shortcomings are part of the human package and that God has worked with imperfect human beings throughout time to accomplish some pretty good things. And those scriptures, I see a place for me. We can certainly learn lessons from the texts of the Book of Mormon, but critical lessons worth understanding lie in the covers of early Christian texts. The implication of family is also a compelling one to me, that we can be aware of those near us and intentionally express a desire to be bound to those people. Joining a family with the hopes of eternal connections gives me a micro version of being tied to the individuals that I do not know a half a world away, or who have lived before me, or who will live after me. My God has a big house, and if I reach the destination that I hope to reach, I will have to share space with many I do not now know. Does a family unit and family unity prepare us for that eventuality? And can we take the transition to the other side, and can it become a little less frightening by uniting with our families on earth with the hope that we will not traverse the eternities alone? My service provider, my Mormonism, provides all these services for me and many others. I can be a bit better and a bit more efficient in my efforts in developing the traits I hope to have as eternal traits. Can the Dalai Lama access these things in his tradition or server? Can my Sunni friends access their God and their traditions? I hope so. But for me, my vehicle to understand the nature of God is tempered by my Mormonism. I hope I can be a loyal voice to help to move my community further ahead and closer to the divine. I've seen friends go through deep crisis in life that has often happened when they have denied who they were and ignored their roots and pretended to be someone else. I've studied other religions and cultures and discovered that I cannot deny what has made me, me. And in large part, I am what I am because I have been touched by Mormonism. It has been my server and a very effective one. I was born a Mormon, culturalized a Mormon, and I intentionally remain a Mormon because that is who I am.
Field some questions or comments.
Yes.
What has been the biggest challenge to your faith, if you will?
Greg? Oh,
I'm
no,
is that so?
You know, I think of the gifts that are given, that hope and faith have been gifts that have been given to me. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not fit in the traditional definition that a lot of Mormons have. I even remember seeing the nun story. Did any of you ever see that? It was an old black and white movie. It was glorious, and it came out when I was about this big. And I had a girlfriend who was just a month different in age, and we were so mystified by the sacrifice, the cutting off of the long, gorgeous hair that the young lady had. And it was very mystical to me, but I could understand why and how. And we would sneak down my basement. I had some dress-up clothes and things, and we'd put on black things on, pretending to be nuns and so forth. So in a way, in answering your question, I think even as a child, there were some innate things that have helped me to be a believer.
Yeah.
Now, has the shape of what I believe in changed? Very good. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I've had any huge, huge crisis outside of a boring high counselor.
Ask her what calling her husband has.
Yes. Sooner the question back there. Yes.
Thank you for that description of your journey. I was just wondering, you know, you've had so many, at least with those that you've encountered in the Christian journey, have you at a deep level felt, you know, brother and sister relationship that you talk to people?
Oh, very definitely. In fact, sometimes some of my deepest connections have been with those that have not been in my faith. And some of those, I had the opportunity, most of my classmates were going on for ordination. And I wanted to figure out what it was that they were talking about when they would return to classes. So for a period of time, I served as a hospital pastor. And the things that you're required to do there is to go in and see if anybody has any particular needs. If they want to pray with you in any tradition, fine. If they want you to call the rabbi or the priest or whatever, that's what you do. But some of those very tender moments with people that, I don't know, holding their hand and having a prayer in their behalf at a time of need is something that brings two souls together in a very, very powerful way. And I have had those experiences within my community as well, but it has not been confined to my community. Yes?
So you are faithfully and socially and environmentally a Mormon. If you were not, or if you became exceptionally dissatisfied for some reason, in your experience, in your religious background, in studying other religions, what would feel most comfortable to you outside of Mormonism? I'm just curious. What would almost work? Where would you go?
You know, the one thing that I think I would do if I found that there was some major something, I can't picture what that would be, that I don't know if I would necessarily turn to any particular denomination, that I would just turn to God and continue a conversation, say, where am I supposed to be at what time? And then see, you know, what happens. And I do feel sorry for a lot of people within Mormonism that when they become disenfranchised, they feel that there's no place to go. And I think that is very, very sad. I think there are a lot of places that you can visit for however long with people of faith and conviction that can sustain you and give you strength. And they may not have a big M after their name. It may be something else. But I select to stay. Yes?
Has your view of God expanded, changed, enlarged in any way since you began your studies?
It has become so much larger and so much more nuanced. And I don't see God as a single dimension. And I don't see my relationship with our core story of the life of Christ as being a flat entity either. I see it so multidimensional, and I see in searching the Old Testament especially, and I wish everybody here could take a good, unbiased Old Testament class where you can learn what the studies are and why people were doing things and what it meant and the conflicts that they had and how they were trying to figure out this messy thing called life and their relationship to God. And I see that life is a lot more complex than my Relief Society president maybe wants me to think it is. Yes.
Jared, thank you for your wonderful talk and for the window into your life and your journey. I enjoyed it so much. One of the things that I wrestle with as somebody who's very active in church, and I have a very strong testimony, but by the same token, I often feel that I see things very differently from many of my fellow brothers and sisters in the church is that I think there is an unconscious, very fine line that people like that try to walk in the context of church, whether it's a Sunday school class or a Relief Society class, of, on the one hand, not wanting to be just all the time and intentionally a divisive and incendiary presence, you know, sort of always getting ready to throw the little bomb and disrupt the class or whatever. But I want to, you know, support our teachers and support those who are really, you know, with earnest, full hearts trying to fulfill their callings each week. And so sometimes I self-censor. But what I have so often found is that I think I'm doing a disservice to all sorts of other people who are sitting there in that exact same class, perhaps listening to something being said or taught that may not be wrong, but the tone and the feel and the, you know, underlying thrust of it is just off base. And so, you know, I do in those circumstances try to, you know, speak out and bring that out in what has always been kind of reassuring to me, but it makes me think that there's this huge silent majority out there that is a little more free-thinking than one might think. Are the number of people who will come up to me afterwards and say, I am so glad you said that. I was just sitting there screaming or feeling uncomfortable or just not feeling the spirit. And so I guess the question I would throw out is, how do we find a way, in harmony with the Spirit, to speak up and to not be gutless wimps and sit there nodding smilingly and sort of say, oh, thanks for the lovely lesson, when we really think maybe something wasn't right or lovely or the spirit or the substance that it was off. How do you find that sweet spot?
And I think that's where we sometimes see the unit being of one thought and the individuals being another that I try to encounter in here. I'm going to tell you one quick thing here. I think we've got 2 minutes.
This is it.
That there was a Sunday school class, and I've told this to several of my friends, taught several weeks ago in our ward, and the well-meaning gospel doctrine teacher gets up there and says, only Mormons can repent. Nobody else can. If they think they're repenting, they're just pretending, they're just trying to make themselves feel better. And this was just a time of Ramadan and those Jewish holidays. And I became so infuriated. I did say, wait a minute. You know, I just could not sit on it anymore. This is preposterous. And it led on to a whole set of other conversations there and in the hall after church. Then I saw something very interesting, because right after Sunday school, we walk into sacrament meeting, and our bishop stands up and says, if there's anybody in the community, or in our ward here that knows anybody in the Washington, D.C. City Council or Building Commission, please let us know, because we're having a hard time getting a church built. Down in Washington, we've got the property that they don't want us to build. And so I went up to the bishop later and I said, well, is it because they don't like the architecture? No. Is it they think there's a problem with parking? No. Is it they don't want us for neighbors? Yeah. And then I thought, okay, what responsibility do we have to our community to do exactly what you said? Because if we make careless comments in the confines of those that we think are just like us, or we can make careless conversation points, saying, all others are the denominations, da-da-da-da-da-da, they'll come back to bite us. Because this bishop wanted us to relay that we're good neighbors. How can we be good neighbors if we're demeaning those that are having this kind of illness? I don't think we can do it. We need to enhance each other. And I think your comments help that process. And I hope everybody will be that type of a voice for that occasion.
Thank you.